website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, since the Israeli occupation entity's creation back in 1948, regime's political and military leaders have demonstrated pattern of repeatedly violating ceasefires with those they call enemies in order to gain military advantage, to usurp more land and expand, or to provoke their opponents into carrying out acts of violence that Israel can then exploit politically and or use to justify military operations already planned. Now, despite a ceasefire deal, Israeli airstrikes have killed some 110 Palestinians in Gaza, including nearly 50 children in the last 24 hours. And more than 250 Palestinians have also been wounded throughout this time in violations of the ceasefire, which has been breached every single day by Israel since its implementation on the 10th of October. And that's no different from the over 5,000 violations against the ceasefire with Lebanon since November 27th, one inked with Beirut. Israel as a serial ceasefire violator and its implications is the focus of our Spotlight program. First, here are our guests. Joining us, Mohammed Al-Khariq, a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Ramallah. And Mr. Jamal Joaquin, professor of international relations at a Lebanese university, Beirut. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Professor Joaquin, we'll start with you, sir, out there in the Lebanese capital. Your initial take on Israel's systemic policy, not just today in Gaza and Lebanon, but throughout its creation and existence, this systemic policy of ceasefire and armistice violations, treaties, laws, you name it. Is there anything that the regime respects and adheres to?
Well, too bad. Based on the history of the Arab-Israeli confrontation and struggle, Israel has always been breaching international law. Actually, it was established against international law and the principles of international law. It was based on the genocide of the people, and at the same time, throughout the history of the conflict, it never abided by any truce or ceasefire unless it was actually supported by military might from the other side. Like it was the case, for example, between 2006-2007 and 2023 in Lebanon, when Israel feared the retaliation of the Islamic resistance. Now, this is the trend for Israel to breach the ceasefires and all agreements that were agreed upon under the auspices, even if it were under the auspices of the United States, which is the main supporter of Israel. And I believe that what's going on now in Gaza is very much similar to what's going on in Lebanon. There was a ceasefire that was agreed upon almost a year ago. However, Israel has been breaching this ceasefire for over a year now, and it's been actually there were hundreds of victims under the ceasefire. The way it's the case now with the ceasefire or so-called ceasefire in Gaza, where Israel is breaching the ceasefire under various pretexts in order to continue its genocidal war against the Palestinian people.
Thank you, Professor Mohammed Al-Khariq. Thank you for your patience and welcome to the conversation. From your perspective, why is the regime's history so riddled, you think, with absolutely no care for adherence to laws, to treaties, and especially ceasefires?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I think the ignorance of the international community
the absence of the real will and the accountability of the international community, and by the way, the Arab countries, encouraged Israel to take bold steps against the Palestinians. And I think, let's name it a genocide, not a ceasefire deal or the violations of the ceasefire deal. Trump and Netanyahu wanted to change the concepts about the genocide, about the Palestinian issue and the conflict in the region by creating many steps. We saw the conference of the peace process in Sharm el-Sheikh, and we saw many conferences. Today, we saw the conference in Paris between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and they are talking about the two-state solution and the peace process during the genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. It's nonsense to talk about the peace process during the genocide. I think the Israeli government and the coalition in Israel wanted to resume the genocide. And this morning they posted or they abused it to continue it in any time, whenever and whatever they want against Gaza. Why? Netanyahu wanted to escape from the two-state solution. By the way, he declared that. And to escape from the any solution for the Palestinians, to give them a settled sovereignty. Because of that, he wanted to go through the first stage in the ceasefire deal. And by the way, he got his hostages, and he's receiving the captives' remains now. After that, I think he decided, with the U.S., by the way, to sabotage, to ruin the second stage in this deal for many reasons. The first one, to get rid of the international stabilization forces, including the Turkish forces and the Egyptian forces. The existence or the presence of the Turkish forces and the Egyptian forces will prevent Netanyahu from resuming the genocide and expanding the territories of the entity, and that will reflect negatively on his political future, at least in his coalition. The second reason, to prevent the Palestinians from reconciliating or unifying their decision reform or form the consensus government, because the unity of the Palestinians will lead to the elections, and that will force the international community to give them a state of sovereignty, and that against the against Netanyahu's narrative, against Netanyahu's fake news, he said many times, okay, you have to see the Palestinians. They have no right to give them the state of sovereignty. They have a division. They have a creative chaos. Yes. They have tanks. This is the point for Netanyahu. Because of that, he
and we'll come back to that.
Resumed the genocide.
And we'll come back to that, Mohammed. Thank you. And Professor Joachim, how do you see the U.S. role and that of other Western players and states in Israel's ceasefire violations? The current Gaza ceasefire, you very well know, is supposedly Donald Trump's 20-point plan, although that is not very accurate. But nevertheless, they're awfully quiet when the regime commits ceasefires. Why?
Well, this is normal. This is the usual trend by the West, which has always sponsored Israeli aggression against the Arabs and Muslims in general, and which has always lent support on one hand to Israel, and on the other hand was always protective of this Zionist entity by preventing it, or let's say protecting it from any punitive actions by the United Nations or by any other international organization that represents the international law that was set mainly by the Western powers. So because since its creation, Israel was meant to be as a tool for Western hegemony in the region. It has served French purposes and objectives in the 19th century, moved on to being a tool in the hands of the British for nearly half a century until the Second World War, and thereafter it became under the auspices and sponsorship of the United States. Of course, there is another dimension for Israel, which is the fact that it's being sponsored by international capitalism, international financial capitalism that is predominantly manipulated and dominated by Zionist families. So this is the reason why we see that Israel can act with impunity towards us. And too bad, what gives Israel more freedom in waging its genocidal wars against not only the Palestinian people, but against other Arab people, for example, it's the paralysis of what we call the Arab nation on one hand, and at the same time of the Islamic nation. So throughout the Arab Islamic world, we barely see any power except for Iran, for example, that is proactively supporting the resistance, whether in Iraq, Lebanon, or Palestine. And it had, and Iran so far has paid dearly for its stance as it's being subjected to blockade for over 5 decades now. And Israel even attempted to topple the regime in Iran during last June when it directed an attack. It waged an attack with the support of the United States. So this is the reality that we need to be aware of, and that gives Israel free hand in waging its genocidal war against the Palestinian people.
Thank you, Professor. And Mohammed, I'd like to put the same question to you. Why don't we see the same level of commitment, motivation, ambition, and will from Washington as we saw when it was an accomplice to the genocide in Gaza next to Tel Aviv? Why don't we see that same level of enthusiasm and commitment to the Gaza ceasefire, especially when they supposedly it's from them, the ceasefire, and they are the key mediator running things, supposedly?
As the professor said, let me be precise with you. The Israeli government took a green light from the United States to launch the military operation against Gaza from the beginning, to vanish the Palestinian and the Palestinians and their sovereignty, by the way. But indeed, the Israeli government has a plan, and this plan to expand its territories and to make their dream come true, the Greater Israel, and to change the face of the Middle East region. And this project will not be real without a green light or support from the U.S. The United States and Israel wanted to go through this plan, and that entails more efforts with the Arab regimes to create the Arab NATO, by the way. By the way, they created it to launch the military operations against Iran, against Lebanon, against Yemen. Maybe, let's name it the multi-war, the multi-front war, and to get rid of the resistance, the axis of resistance. At the same time, they wanted to strengthen the political parties inside these countries, inside these positions, to make them as the leaders or something else. But to sum it all up, I think the mediators are facing a formidable challenge, especially the Turkish mediator. The mediation, by the way, is very weak, and that will lead to more escalation from the Israeli government against the Palestinians and the neighboring countries, by the way. and that will reflect negatively on the national security of the Arab regimes and the Arab countries, including the Palestinians and their state that the international community promised them with. But when you talk about the mediators, okay, there's a problem with them. When you talk about the transformations in the region, yes, Netanyahu and Trump decided to change the reality and to reform the new structures on the basis of the deterrence, intimidation, and the expansion plan for Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Professor Joaquim, I'd really like to ask you, get your take on this two particular ceasefire violations and why. Each is obviously designed to elicit a different response from the party that the occupation is aimed at trying to elicit a response from. One in Lebanese resistance, one in Palestinian resistance in Gaza. What do you feel the violations of the Gaza ceasefire are geared to try to elicit from the Palestinians and to give Israel to what pretext to do what? And the same with Lebanon. Why have we seen 5,000 plus violations and continued occupation of five key sites in Lebanon? To what objective there as well?
Well, we need to admit the fact that the collapse of the Syrian regime, which was presided by President Bashar al-Assad, has caused an earthquake in the region and a major reshuffle of alliances and balance of power, not to the favor of the axis of resistance, and to the favor, of course, of the Americans and the Zionists, because for nearly six decades, Syria has been the major or the forefront for the confrontation with Israel, especially after Egypt withdrew from the conflict with Israel due to the signing of the Camp David Agreement. And it was Syria that was supporting the resistance groups even before the rise of or the establishment of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So, and after the rise of the Islamic Revolution, the Iran could only channel its aid and support to various resistance groups, including that of Lebanon and of Palestine, via Syria. Now that the Syrian regime collapsed and Syria is being controlled by a regime that is first unstable and that is sponsored, on the other hand, by Turkey, Israel, and the United States, there is no chance, or let's say it has become difficult for the resistance in Lebanon and the resistance in Palestine to secure aid, logistical aid. Of course, they are receiving aid in a way or another. However, it has become much harder now to get this aid. I believe that for nearly a year now, Hezbollah has been trying to rebuild its capabilities and at the same time build alternative channels to get support, not only from Iran, but from various sources, in order to be let's say prepare itself for the upcoming round, because I believe that this situation cannot prevail. And at one point, Hezbollah, for example, will retaliate. It's the same with Hamas and other resistance groups in Gaza. They are besieged, they are encircled, and at the same time, this major, let's say, shift in the balance of power has negatively affected the ISIS of resistance. I believe that also Hamas and other resistance groups in Palestine are trying to gain time to rebuild their capabilities, and at the same time count on time in order for this balance of power to be changed one more time. Maybe we should count on Iran one more time, because now that the United States feels secure in the Near East after the collapse of the Syrian regime, it's directing its attention elsewhere, mainly to the Transcaucasus region, in order to further undermine the Iranian national security and, of course, Russian national security. So it's about time for, or let's say, it's a matter of time for Iran to retaliate. Maybe they are trying to look for ways in order to readjust the balance of power in the region. I don't know. I don't have information in that regard. But if the situation remains as is, because the Israelis and the Americans are offering no compromise or middle ground with their opponents, so they are driving these opponents to the corner. And at one point, these opponents, mainly the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah, will retaliate, will go into action, will not leave Israel act in impunity. And but we still need some time to see that. There is also another factor, which is that of the American internal crisis. Now that America is acting in a hostile manner in various parts of the world, it's because the establishment there feels that it's being weakened, and it needs to overcome its internal divisions and contradictions by achieving major victories abroad. However, if the United States or the contradictions within the United States go beyond control, I believe that this will be our way for salvation. The United States goes deeper into its own crisis.
Thank you, Professor Joaquin Mohammed. We don't have a lot of time left, but I really want to get that same question. We have two perpetual sets of violations, one taking place in the thousands in Lebanon since November 27th, one taking place every single day, multiple casualties, over 106 before this 125 over the last 24 hours. Since October 10th in Gaza. Two different sets of ceasefires, obviously, with two different objectives and purpose. Break them down really quick in less than a minute and a half, if you can, please.
I think the proof is in the pudding. Israel carried out many violations, committed many violations against the Palestinians and the Lebanese, and the ceasefire deal, by the way, in Gaza and in Lebanon. Israel wanted to let it as a normal action, as a routine in Lebanon and in Gaza, to achieve its goals. By the way, Netanyahu didn't achieve his goals in Lebanon and in Gaza. When you ask me how, I will tell you. When we just think about the results, after 2 years of genocide and starvation and war against five or six countries in the region from the Israeli occupation, there is no expansion plan on the ground. there is no actions. Netanyahu didn't disarm Hezbollah, didn't disarm Hamas, didn't impose the theater in Gaza, didn't annex the West Bank. All of these points, he promised. He promised the Israeli society from the beginning to achieve. But now there is nothing on the ground. Because of that, I think Israel and the U.S. decided to change the reality, decided to prepare for a new a new round of escalation in the region, at the expense of the Palestinians, by the way, at the expense of the Arab regimes, Arab countries, the national security of Arab countries. And now, not to mention that the Israeli settlers in the West Bank with the Israeli soldiers are carrying out daily attacks against the Palestinians to prevent them from the daily life, to put more pressure on them, to force them to leave, or at least to cram them into the heart of the cities, to take the land, to take the pastoral areas and the water springs. But in Gaza, they wanted to create chaos, to force people to leave, and they will violate the ceasefire deal. They will resume the genocide next days under the pretext of self-defense. And as Trump said, he said a dangerous speech. He said a dangerous words about the genocide. He justified the genocide of Israel as a self-defense. It's unbelievable, unbearable situation in this time. Because of that, I think without a strong stance from the Arab countries and the international community, we will see more escalation in the region, and we will see more confrontations and instability.
Gentlemen, thank you both. It's a pleasure having you both on. Mohammed Al-Kik, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Ramallah, and also Professor Jamal Waqim, professor of international relations from Lebanese University, joining us from Beirut. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Like Muhammad from IRIB English Radio. In this program, what we do is to talk about different moral virtues of the perfect and greatest character in the world of Islam, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. And our aim of this program is for us as Muslims to learn from this great character how to live and make all these patterns in our daily lives as lessons. Well, when we think about the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, we often remember his mercy, his patience and his devotion to God. But one remarkable quality that deserves more reflection is how he recognized the unique strength of every individual. You know, he never treated people as if they were identical pieces in a crowd. Instead, he saw their talents, their personalities, and their potential. And then, with wisdom, he helped them grow in roles that suited them best. This principle is rooted in the Holy Book of Quran itself. In Surah Al-Hujarat, verse number 13, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala declares, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الناس إنا خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا إن أكرمكم عند الله أتقاكم إن الله عليم خبير. O mankind, indeed we created you from male and female and made you peoples and tribes so that you may know one another. Surely, the most honored of you in the sight of Allah is the most God-conscious. Diversity, whether in background, in skills or personalities, is not a flaw. It is part of the divine plan of every individual. And the Prophet ﷺ embodied this by building a community where each person could contribute according to their strength. Take the example of Bilal al-Habashi, who was a man of Ethiopian origin who had once been enslaved. The Prophet ﷺ did not see him through the lens of race or status. Instead, he recognized Bilal's deep faith and powerful voice. When the call to prayer was established, the Prophet ﷺ chose Bilal as the first muezzin of Islam. Imagine the scene, a man once treated as property, now standing on the rooftops of Medina, calling believers to worship. This was not only an honor for Bilal, it was a lesson for the whole community that talents, not social hierarchies, define a person's role. Another striking story is that of Ammar ibn Yasir. He came from a humble background and his family endured severe torture for believing in God. The Prophet ﷺ saw in Ammar a heart full of patience and a spirit of endurance. Instead of dismissing his suffering, the Prophet ﷺ reassured him, saying, "Patience, O family of Yasir, your promised place is paradise." Ammar's strength was not in wealth or influence, but in resilience. The Prophet ﷺ valued that and gave him a place of honor among his companions.
You are my one true love, taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Like Muhammad, and we are talking about this beautiful moral virtue of Prophet ﷺ, which was his treating talents of every individual in their special way. Well, the Prophet ﷺ also nurtured the courage of young people. You know, one of the most remarkable examples is Usama ibn Zayd. Still a teenager, Usama was appointed by the Prophet ﷺ as commander of an army that included senior companions. Some people were surprised, how could such a young man lead? But the Prophet insisted and he said, "You criticize his leadership, but by God he is worthy of it, and so was his father before him." This was a powerful message that talent and character mattered more than age or seniority for Prophet ﷺ. And even women were recognized for their unique gifts by Prophet ﷺ. You know, Umm Salama, one of the Prophet's wives, was known for her wisdom and insight. During the treaty of Hudaybiyah, when many companions were disheartened and hesitant, the Prophet ﷺ consulted her. She advised him on how to lead by example in performing the rituals. He followed her advice and the companions quickly did the same. Her counsel changed the course of events, and the Prophet's respect for her intelligence shows how he valued the contributions of women in shaping the community. And even in smaller moments, his sensitivity to individuality shone through. You know, when a man came to him asking a permission to avoid battle, explaining that he was not brave enough for fighting, the Prophet ﷺ did not shame him. Instead, he asked what he was good at. The man replied that he enjoyed tending to gardens. So the Prophet ﷺ encouraged him to serve the community through farming and supporting others with food. Not everyone had to be a warrior. Each person could serve God in their own way. The Prophet also taught that every skill could be a form of worship. In Nahj al-Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam recalls that the Messenger of God sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, "The worth of every person is in what he does best." This principle guided how Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam treated people, not by their wealth, tribe, appearance, or by their ability, but by their ability to contribute something that is meaningful. Even children were not overlooked. The Prophet ﷺ noticed their talents and nurtured them with kindness. The Holy Book of Quran describes the qualities of a trustworthy leader. The best one you can hire is strong and trustworthy. The Prophet ﷺ applied this principle in choosing people for tasks, ensuring that talent and reliability determined a person's position, not mere connections. In our families, communities, and workplace, it is easy to overlook talents that do not fit conventional models. But the Prophet's example calls us to see people through a deeper lens, with unique gift has God placed in that person. How can that gift serve others? By honoring individuals' strength, the Prophet ﷺ built a community that was not only united in faith, but enriched by diversity. And that is why his legacy continues to inspire hearts across the world. Okay, well, thank you very much, dear listeners. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, Ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing?
About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Galenu was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an eco-tourism village. Kilometers from Galeno lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahonie Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahonie Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahonie Ghulaman suggest that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahonie Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk, beautifully designed. And also I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Where do you think beautiful doors opened up to? There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts.
Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولا